Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Let's get going. 29 past the hour. Hey, everybody, I'm Kyle Risdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense.
And I am Kimberly Adams. Welcome to What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, how we celebrate hump day over here at Make Me Smart. Yeah. It's where we answer questions that you, our listeners, have sent in. And if you, our listeners, have a question about the economy, business, or tech, you can send it to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 508-UB-SMART.
All right, question number one today, political campaign donations. Go.
Hi, my name is Jan. I'm living in Thailand, but I'm a U.S. citizen. And I am curious to know if it makes any difference at all right now about donating monies to a political candidate or a particular party. Does it make a difference? And if you do donate right now and they don't use the money, what happens to the money? Thank you.
Over to you, once upon a time Washington correspondent for Marketplace.
I'm still a Washington correspondent. Right. I do politics things sometimes. And in this case, so I'm going to answer the exact question first and then go a little bit broader. At this point in the campaign, we're like less than a week out. The money that you donate to a given candidate or party is very unlikely to be spent directly in this election. What is more likely to happen is that those dollars will end up being spent on after election stuff, just because of the timeline it takes to process money and all that stuff. Yeah. Anyhow, but that after the election money is really interesting because there are certain things candidates can do with that money and certain things that they can't. So if you back up, money really does matter in campaigns. The Center for Responsive Politics, which runs this website, which is really great, called Open Secrets, which tracks money in politics in 2020, and they've looked at this in many other cycles as well, it showed that for House and Senate races, in the vast majority of the time, the candidate who raised and spent the most money won. It doesn't always hold. See 2016 presidential election. Yeah. And that, of course, is a presidential, but not House and Senate. But generally, more money, more power, you win. Small donors, super important to these campaigns. Individual donations can really not only give a lot of money in mass, but also it's a good talking point for campaigns to say that their money is coming from individual donors. And also, if somebody is donating to a campaign, that often means that they are much more likely to show up to vote. So there's that part. Now then, circling back to the after campaign money, candidates can use that money to pay off bills from their campaign. So maybe you still have consultants you owe money to, or you rented a big venue for your election night watch party and you got to pay for that. Somebody's got to clean up all the confetti. Or if maybe you have to, pay for your web servers or winding down your campaign offices and stuff. All that stuff costs money. Also, the Supreme Court back in May lifted some of the limits on how campaigns could use the money after elections to pay themselves back for personal loans that they made into their campaign. We talked about that here on the show. And a lot of times candidates will hold on to that cash to save it for their next campaign. Or maybe they were running for president and didn't make it past the primaries, so they use the money for their Senate campaign, or vice versa. They have leftover money from a Senate campaign and use it to run for president. Or if you're like former President Trump, you convert the money into a PAC, that a political action committee, and you keep raising money and you can spend that money pretty much however you want. CBS News did a breakdown on what happened to the extra campaign cash raised following the primaries in 2020, and we're going to link to that on our website.
Yeah, it's campaign cash. It's endlessly fascinating. Endlessly
so fascinating.
And also, by the way, endlessly infuriating. If I could just editorialize for about 2 seconds, right?
I don't think that's editorializing. I think it infuriates just about everybody.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right. Next up, Bill in New Lebanon, New York, wrote in to ask, when the U.S. releases oil from the strategic reserves, is it sold at market prices? If the government purchased the oil at $50 a barrel and sells it at $85 a barrel, does the government keep the difference?
Well, I mean, so first of all, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, obviously in the news a lot lately because President Biden has authorized the release of many, 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 many millions of barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, set up, by the way, in the 1970s after the Arab oil embargoes, if anybody listening to this podcast remembers those, to be used for strategic purposes, not, to editorialize one more time, to keep gas prices low. But that's a whole different thing. Government accounting is, number one, a shell game, right? I mean, when the government moves pots of money around, it is not robbing Peter to pay Paul, but it's one pocket to another pocket. So it's really tricky. The short answer to the question is that it is sold at auction, right? So I was going to say producers, but actually producers and refiners submit bids to the SPR, to the Department of Energy. And the government then accepts, obviously, the highest bid. Now, it also does have to, the government does have to replenish that stockpile, right? Because we've got lots and lots of extra space now in those salt caverns in Texas and Louisiana, which is where the oil is stored, that we have to fill back up again. And the government does wind up paying market rate for those. And that becomes a challenge if they sold low and they're going to buy high, like today, oil's back up over $90 a barrel. So that's kind of a challenge. So anyway, SPR, Strategic Petroleum Reserve, not keep gas prices lower, Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It can affect the government's finances. Kinda.
Okay, but to take the non-cynical possibility, and yes, we all know that it's probably linked to trying to lower gas prices. But if the original purpose was during the Arab oil embargo, right now we do have sanctions against Russia. And there is a, you know, military national security interest in not getting oil and natural gas from certain parts of the world. Doesn't that kind of fall into the same category?
Well, yeah, except for a couple of things. Number one, oil is a globally traded commodity, right? And we operate on the extreme fringes of viability. We produce about 100 million barrels of oil a day in the global economy. We use about 100 million barrels a day in the global economy. So it's really, really, really thin, those margins. So what Biden is doing here is not adding any extra, right? He's meeting the capacity that we need. Also, let's remember that it was about becoming energy independent. It wasn't about gas prices. It was about not having to rely on Arab nations and Gulf nations and now today OPEC Plus to meet our oil supplies. So I guess nominally, sure, you could say that it is strategically in our interest to release it right now so we're not dependent on those guys. But really, it's about gas prices.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it kind of is, right? Especially now in you know, a midterm that the president's
midterms.
Getting whacked on inflation about it. And of course, the even though gas prices are lower than they used to be a number of months ago, that's what he's getting beat up about, because you see those every time you're driving down the road in, you know, 8-inch high letters. So anyway, OK, so there was a news item last week about Meta, which I think we just don't even have to say is the parent company of Facebook anymore. I think everybody gets that.
I don't think so.
Meta had to pay an almost $25 million fine for violating campaign finance disclosure laws. Lots of campaign money on the program today. Here we go.
Hi, Make Me Smart crew. This is Peyton in Rochester, New York.
Hi, Peyton.
So, my question. Why is the U.S. so bad at punishing corporations for breaking the law? And why are the fines always so laughably or maybe heartbreakingly small? Thanks for making me smart. Mm-hmm.
Only in this context would we talk about $25 million as heartbreakingly small. But to recap, last week there was a judge in Washington State that fined Meta the $24.7 million for repeatedly and intentionally, according to the verdict, breaking the state's political ad transparency law. It's believed to be one of the largest penalties of its kind in U.S. history. And, you know, I'm sure we're going to link to some coverage about that. The attorney general's office had also sued Meta in 2018 for breaking the same law, which is one of the reasons why they said you're still doing it intentionally in such a big number. It really isn't a drop in the bucket for these companies. It's a rounding error in some cases. And so we talked to Yosef Gattacho, who is the Media and Democracy Program Director at Common Cause. And one of the things he said was that these fines maybe aren't the best way to get companies like Meta to stop breaking the law, but they are the only option that regulators and enforcers of these laws actually have. This is the tool that Congress has given them to punish these companies. And he said that fines are sometimes seen as the cost of doing business. Mm-hmm. So for Facebook or Meta, you know, if you're sitting there and you're looking at your numbers and thinking about how much it's going to cost you to develop whatever program you need to or lay down whatever infrastructure is necessary and the time it's going to take you and, you know, the air quote hassle to come up with a system to block these political ads, layer that on top of the revenue that you're going to lose, maybe they're just like, $25 million, not so bad. Mm-hmm. It's worth it. And, you know, he brought up how the FTC fined Facebook $5 billion in 2019 for user privacy issues. And the company's stock actually went up after that because, you know, the markets are like, oh, great, you solved that problem, moving on. And so there's probably other strategies that would work better, like enforcement strategies, like court orders that actually force a company to change its behavior, or, you know, maybe even personal liabilities for executives that would, you know, maybe bring some people to actually be held accountable for the things that the mm-hmm. companies they run mm-hmm. do. But good luck getting that through Congress.
For sure. For sure. Should we just go right to the last one here? Let's go right to the last one.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. Let me scroll down. Oh, right. The other day, Kai, you mentioned that you're selling your minivan to get an electric vehicle. And Graham in Ann Arbor wrote in to ask, can you walk us through how you're choosing and what brand and model you're planning on getting?
Yeah, so it's time, you know, with the kids basically gone, right? We've got one out of four children still in the house. We just don't need a minivan anymore, and it makes no sense for me to be driving around in this big cavernous thing. And also, as I think I said the other day, it cost me $108 to fill up, and I'm just like, I'm not doing that anymore. So we are going to buy an EV. I did a bunch of research. I went online and checked out, you know, Car and Driver and a bunch of the automotive experts. I read up on Dan Neil in the Wall Street Journal. He's a former Marketplace contributor, also really knowledgeable about cars, and did a bunch of reading and landed. And here's what I was looking for. I was looking for range. I was looking for chargeability, which is to say how fast it can take a charge, which is a function of a whole lot of different things. By the way, there's a whole like language you have to learn, and there's a bunch of things you have to learn with an EV, which I didn't really think about. But that comes into it. Cost was a factor. And also, you know, we don't need a minivan, but we want a little bit of room, right? Throw some bags in the back or a dog or two or, you know, whatever. So we came down on, a Hyundai Ioniq 5. We're pretty excited about it. And it should be here in a couple of weeks. So that's kind of what I did.
Is it big enough for your mountain bike, or do you have a bike rack?
I have a bike rack. Actually, the car, the specific car we're getting comes with a tow hitch on it, and I'm gonna buy a bike rack that fits in there. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. I'm pretty excited about it.
Good luck.
Thank you. I hope you have fun with it. So here's what Bridget wants to know, and Marissa, I imagine. How did you think about buying a motorcycle?
Which
goes way back, right? I mean, you've had that motorcycle.
It goes way back, yeah. I started riding a scooter when I was in Egypt. So I got my motorcycle license before I moved to Egypt the most recent time in 2012, because I figured I'd probably want to get around that way because traffic is awful. But I ended up getting a scooter, and it was like a 300cc scooter in Egypt, just because gear shifting is not my strong point. I'm not really great at it. And so I had my scooter in Egypt and then sold it before I left. And then when I came here, I wanted to get something bigger so I could get on the highway, because you can't really do much with a 300cc scooter on highways in the United States. And so I wanted to upgrade to something like 700 or 800 cc's. And I ended up finding a used bike on Craigslist that was really reasonably priced. And it's a Honda CTX 700. And it has something called dual clutch transmission, which means it can operate and either a manual or automatic mode, which means that if I don't want to, I don't have to gear shift. And so it looks like a real motorcycle. It is a real motorcycle, but I can ride it like a scooter.
Sorry, I'm Googling the image now. Look at this, Honda CTX 700. Oh, look at that.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. And it's great. And I, of course, I researched the VIN numbers and everything like that, sure it hadn't been in any accidents and all those things. And yeah, it was great.
Well, there we go. And that concludes the automotive section of this podcast. And What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? Back tomorrow, as we always are. Making you smart on the news of the day. We'll do a Make Me Smile as well.
Yeah, and in the meantime, keep sending us your questions. Our email is makemesmart@marketplace.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 508-UB-SMART.
So wait, do you have a car too?
No, I don't. Just a motorcycle. And I walk and take the metro and stuff.
Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera and Courtney Bergsicker. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletters.
Today's show was engineered by Juan Carlos Torrado. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Bridget Bodner is working on the new season of Million Bazillion right now, but she's still around. Donna Tam is the director of On Demand.
For now. Anyway, yeah.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.